The voice of a changing world, Chris Smith, on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hey, good to have your company. We are going to get to Dr. Will Davies a little later in the program because Will is a war historian, and he's going to tell us about an aspect of the First World War that a relative of mine played a role in that changed the course of the outcome of World War One. And it is an amazing story that people need to hear about, Australians in particular, because if it weren't for the Australians at Villa Bretonneux, we would not have defeated and stopped the Germans getting into Paris in World War One. We'll hear from Will Davies a little bit later. We'll get to Sally Grover very shortly. But, you know, I've just said on the issue of energy, and I say it just about every day, that if you are serious about being a government without bias, and a government who wanted to do the best in terms of energy prices for its people, what you would do is have a task force out doing the best they could to investigate the likelihood of using nuclear power in Australia, given the fact that about 40 countries have dedicated money already to either investigating or commissioning the building of small modular nuclear reactors. It would make sense as far as Australia is concerned, because it's got all the uranium, that we would do the same thing. Not press buttons, not sign off, not spend too much money, but a task force at the very least. And I've said it over and again. But they do have time to set up a task force on AI. The government will establish a permanent advisory body on artificial intelligence that will include representatives from organisations such as businesses and institutions that are using AI tools. According to the Australian Financial Review, the new advisory body could be charged with overseeing AI laws, here we go, a little bit of censorship again, that would apply to a range of high-risk industries such as healthcare, finance and housing. The current temporary body, the Artificial Intelligence Expert Group, that's a nifty name, is made up of academics and expertise in AI standards, technologies such as autonomous driving and ethics. It was set up last February, and according to Science and Industry Minister Ed Husic, it has been developing definitions of high risk and investigating options for mandatory guardrails. Now, wouldn't you just think about transposing that into the area of energy and go, why don't we set up, say, modular nuclear reactor expert group where they can develop definitions of high risk and investigate options for mandatory guardrails. You could actually transpose all of that to create something that made sense in the nuclear space, but no. It's the N word. It's the new N word in Australia. We can't go down that track. We're going to be led by windmills. Whenever the sun doesn't shine and when the wind doesn't blow, we won't be able to power our homes or our businesses, but that's where our baseload power is going to come from solely. That hasn't happened in any other country in the world. Good luck. Meanwhile, how's this for stuffing up at work? German luxury car dealer, Mechatronic, they trusted a 24-year-old employee with a Ferrari. Yes. The 24-year-old employee was able to drive a Ferrari F40. He drove it to a nearby car show because the Ferrari was one of the top draw cards, a Ferrari F40. The trip turned out to be rather expensive as the young driver crashed the vintage Ferrari in a tunnel. The F40 was being driven to Motor World, but with just 11 miles remaining on the trip, the driver lost control in the middle of the tunnel near Stuttgart. A police spokesman said it is currently unknown whether this was due to a technical defect or excessive speed. The Ferrari F14 is valued at $3 million. This is Chris Smith on TNT.
Going 360 on the headlines.
It's really well-balanced conversation.
Today's News Talk Radio,
TNT.
Well, 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 what a couple of weeks Sally Grover has had. Well, you could say she's had an incredible 2 years leading up to that recent federal court case. Giggle versus Tickle. You don't need me to tell you the story. It's about her Giggle women-only website, but of course all of a sudden a biological man wanted to be part of it. And that's when Sally said, that ain't happening. And then they end up in the federal court. I've got Sally Grover with me right now. Sally, I don't say happy Anzac Day, but welcome on this very special Anzac Day. And thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, now that you've had a chance to breathe, now that you have a chance to forget about doing any more interviews for the time being, you've had a chance to reflect, think about what you said in the witness box, think about what they said, think about what the legal eagle said, what the judge intimated. What's your gut feeling telling you?
Honestly, I can't even speculate. I have absolutely no idea. I mean, I know what I want. Like, obviously, I want to win in federal court and move on with my life and go and run a platform strictly for women. That would be fantastic.
Are you serious?
That's what I want, but I don't think, I don't know. I've said from the beginning that I am willing to go to the High Court.
Yeah.
When I got the Australian Human Rights Commission complaint, one of the things that was said by sort of everyone in the, like, you know, sort of in the legal know and everything, they always said this case will go to the High Court. So I've always been very mentally and emotionally prepared to go to the High Court. So I'm sort of not putting all of my eggs in the federal court basket, if you know what I mean. The ruling here, I'm not basing sort of everything on it. It's like we still have the High Court. That's really the verdict that matters ultimately, because it's the final one that we could get in an Australian.
It does, but what if the federal court found in your favour?
Wouldn't that be amazing? It'd be the first one I've had in a while.
Wow.
It would be amazing. So yeah, I can't speculate. I have no idea. And you know, I do, you know, I have respect for the process, even if I don't have respect for the premise of the case.
Were you happy with the way things were put forward by your team in court? No doubt there were probably P's and Q's that could have been refined a bit. There always is in a court case, because the person who's heavily involved in the court case seems to know more about the case than the legal eagles who deal with different cases on different days. But having said all of that, were you happy with the way your case was presented?
Without a doubt. And I will say, like, my team, one, they're like remarkable women and they're so intelligent and professional and just fantastic in general. But, you know, we were all invested in this case. We were a team of women. I think it's between all of us. We have 17 daughters. So we actually care about the outcome. This wasn't for my legal team. It wasn't just, you know, a normal case where, you know, it's just like contract law or some sort of dispute that you're really detached from. This is a case where it's like, no, we actually want to have women's rights protected in law, not just for ourselves, but for our daughters as well. So yeah, it was a bit different. We were all very emotionally exhausted by the end of the week because of what it means to all of us.
And one of the stories that kept being reported from the courts over the 4 days were the number of people and supporters that turned up. Many couldn't get into the courtroom.
It was amazing. Women from all over Australia came to support us and to listen. And again, because they care, it's their rights as well. This isn't a case just about, you know, some guy who claims to be a woman who wants to go on an app and that's the sort of beginning and end of it. This is the first time in the world that sex and gender identity have been in conflict so directly in court. It is the What Is a Woman case. And it's the case, the first step for women in Australia. And then because of the international implications of our constitutional challenge and our sort of responsibilities to CEDAW, of getting women's rights established back in law and women being established as a legal class of people that men cannot identify into. So it's just the first step of what will be many, but it's an important one.
It is bizarre, isn't it? And you sent me a note today saying this is where we have this bizarre case of, you know, we're reporting regularly at the moment about the fact that a woman is being violently killed in Australia every 4 days in 2024, which is a total and utter outrage. And, you know, I've had discussions here about what we do about that, and I'm quite happy to have that discussion with you. But the fact is, we're reporting it like as if we all know what a woman is, but this is the definitional grey area, isn't it?
Well, this is the thing. It's that, we can't live in a country where the only people who are allowed to correctly identify a woman are male predators. But that if at the moment, I mean, I'm being punished for knowing what a woman is. I'm in court for it. Obviously, this is why we're fighting, is because everyone actually does know what a woman is, and sometimes in really positive ways, and then other times in really negative ways, that this is the psychology of a woman. This is what women go out into the world with, knowing that there are some guys out there who really just want to go after us because they can, because they're bigger than us, they're stronger than us, we're easy targets in that respect. Yeah. And, you know, that I see some of the solutions of like, oh, you know, women, there should be laws passed so women can carry pepper spray. Well, you know what? The definition of a woman is going to be really important there, because otherwise any man can just go and self-ID as a woman and get that pepper spray too. This is what we're fighting for. Women need to be protected in law and defined in law so we can actually go and protect women's rights in society. And so all of the politicians who are now like Katie Gallagher and the rest of them that are going on about all of this, like, obviously I agree with them. Something needs to be done, but it's like, hi, I'm trying to do it. And you guys, none of you will acknowledge me. You pretend I don't exist. And you're actually just proving my point.
How has the media reacted abroad? Because I've seen a lot of material online where you have been interviewed, and a lot of podcasts, so independent journalism. But how has the reaction been abroad, just before, during, and straight after the case?
International media has been so supportive of me, and much more than here. Like, as we know, I mean, you are the only Australian journalist who consistently gives me a voice. I will say overall, during the trial, the Australian media, I mean, they sort of acknowledged it for the first time in 2 years. So that was quite nice. You know, ABC didn't do a great job, tried to portray me as some sort of crazed harasser. Just total misogynistic sexism, horrible. Like, evidently everyone at ABC knows who the woman actually is in this story. I don't have a lot of time for them. But yeah, I mean, in the international media landscape, they're looking at Australia going, what are you doing? You guys have lost your minds.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. There was a campaign that began on television this week, run by the federal government, about, hey, ladies and gentlemen, you're about to get a tax cut. And we could argue here about whether that's a fair campaign to run at this time, or whether it's just politicking leading up to next year's election or not. But putting that aside, what about a campaign right now about looking after women, if we know what they are, and not killing them as much as we do?
Exactly. I mean, you know, the horrific murders that happened in Bondi a few weeks ago. I mean, that was 2 days after our hearing ended, where we were there explaining that women are, it is a unique experience being a woman.
Yeah.
You know, that horrible human being who walked through that shopping center and killed women, and don't get me wrong, he killed a man and he injured some men who were trying to intervene to save the women.
Yeah, they were accidents.
I don't minimize that. It's still lives lost. It's still people like these men.
But in terms of intent, they were accidents.
Exactly. This guy was there to kill women. You know what he didn't do? He didn't stop and ask pronouns. He didn't stop and ask, are you wearing women's clothes or men's clothes? He didn't ask what their gender identity was. He saw women and went for them. That is what it is to be a woman. Obviously, a woman is an adult human female, but the psychology of being a woman, what we exist in the world, why we want some kind of special legal provisions and protections, this is why. And I am watching how the political landscape is playing out on this. And I just, you know, I do want to give the middle finger to a lot of the politicians, because you guys could help me. Any single one of them could help me.
Yeah, they could. They don't choose to. I've got to take a quick break. We'll come back. There's so much to talk about what's happening in the trans space worldwide. And not a lot of it is good news, but we'll get there. Sally Grover, our guest on TNT.
TNT's Patrick Henningsen.
All the focus of the West, of Washington and its allies, are all focused on Israel right now, to support and help Israel and to somehow contain and deter Iran. Okay. So that means that Russia kind of has an open field with regards to what it wants to do. So think about that for a moment. Could we have a situation in this new world, this multipolar world, where the Iranians and the Russians, they're allies, and certainly Russia's not going to slap Iran on the wrist for this latest salvo against Israel. Why? Because it absolutely ties up the United States and its allies right now in the Middle East.
Patrick Henningsen on today's News Talk, TNT.
In a democracy, the majority vote rules.
But in most democracies, you can only vote for change every 3 or 4 years. To understand what people want, governments and political parties use focus groups. These focus groups can include as little as 20 people. Australia is a country of over 25 million people. Does making decisions based on 20 people sound fair to you? Have your say. Be heard in between elections. Download the For My Say app now. That is number 4, My Say.
Internet. A stream online.
TNTRadio.live. Today's News Talk Radio. TNT.
Well, Sally Grover, I want to talk to you about the Flying Bats Football Club. Now, before people sort of snigger, this is a major issue in junior sport in Australia. They've won every match they've played during the four-week Beryl Ackroyd Cup, including a 10-0 victory in which one of their trans players scored a double hat trick, so 6 goals, and they've gone on to continue winning. There is some footage now being played. I think it's on 2GB, footage where some of the players for the Flying Bats have been very, very aggressive, overly aggressive if you've seen the video. Now, the outraged dad of a player from a rival team has spoken out, saying he is absolutely furious. What is wrong? This is a group, as I understand it, of 5 or 6 trans women. And if you look at the team photo, obviously very, very well physically built biological men playing in a girls' competition. Get out of here.
This is just madness. Madness. The craziest thing is, though, it's going to take something like this for people to really start doing something. It's going to actually take a woman being, or girl being seriously injured or worse, killed. Yep. For people to actually, but they are being injured. That's the thing.
Yeah.
This is just insane. Wait, how you can tell that this is just about these men being able to do whatever they want to do is, you know, there's just never calls for females to be playing on the men's team, isn't there? You know, like you've got like the Peter Fitzsimons types who are always like, yeah, you know, trans women in women's sports, if you don't agree with that, you're a bigot. Never saying that trans men should be playing on the Wallabies. One, because they all know it's dangerous. And two, they know it would ruin the game. But when it comes to women's sports, they just don't care. We're just expected to accept it. No, it is dangerous. It is unfair. I think that it's time for that team to, or the people who are involved, or they're playing against it, whoever. It's time for legal action. This issue will be settled in the courts.
Yeah.
At the moment, there is no political appetite for it because there are just so many cowards who are in the political system in Australia at the moment.
Yeah.
But no, it's like time to stand up for yourself. If I could say anything to these girls and young women who are on these teams is, we all have your back. Don't play. Stop. Tell them no.
The father used a word or a descriptor that I can't remember, but it hit me like a ton of bricks. It was like he was saying, you should stand on the sidelines and watch the way these biological men play against the girls. And I think he was saying it was something like horrifying.
Yeah.
It was grossly aggressive and horrifying, I think the word was. If he didn't use that, he used terrifying or something. That's from a father watching his own child play a game that they're supposed to love.
Yeah, I mean, gosh, that dad could just go on the field, identify as a woman and go and teach them a lesson, couldn't he? I don't trust a man who wants to identify as a woman, take opportunities and fairness and safety away from women, and then go onto a sporting field and actually try to hurt them.
Yeah.
Like, this is not a marginalized group in like some sort of horrible oppressed group in society. These are like just really horrible men.
Yeah. Nasty, nasty, gross and nasty.
Yeah.
All right. Meanwhile, a group of more than 400 current and former Olympic professional and collegiate athletes, over 300 academics and roughly 100 advocacy groups have released separate letters Tuesday this week urging the NCAA in the United States not to ban transgender women from competing in women's college sports. The letters were coordinated by LGBTQ sports advocacy group Athlete Alley, and the signatories include former US women's national team soccer co-captain Megan Rapinoe, of course, former WNBA and Olympic basketball star Sue Bird, and former NFL defensive end R.K. Russell. The loud minority, Sally, having their say.
Yeah, I mean, all of those women who are out there who have built, you know, have achieved their dreams and their goals, and earned their fame and money through women's sports to then turn around and try and destroy that for all of the women and girls coming up behind them, give it all back.
Yeah.
Give it all back. If you don't care about the category of women's sports, don't dine out on it. But yeah. Who on earth do you think you are? Go and start a new career playing with the men. See if you can recreate the success that you had. You can't. These people are idiots. They are morons to be doing this, whether there's money in it for them now to be doing it. But this is not progress. A bunch of women athletes turning around and saying, oh, no, women's sports actually doesn't matter. No. I mean, it's like some sort of form of self-hatred. It's absurd. And they're doing it all just so these incredibly entitled, nasty, vicious men can get whatever they want.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, I think eventually they'll pretend they never did it. At the moment, there's some kind of social currency in doing it. They think they're cool. They get popular. They're not called transphobic. They don't care if women like me call them like misogynistic. They don't care. They care if they're sort of in this little bubble that they live in, that they're validated and that they're sort of approved and, you know, no one turns on them. Eventually, there'll be whole social currency in it.
Yeah. See, you mentioned the flying bats and the injuries that have already occurred. Now, as I recall, there was a broken leg or two that have occurred playing the Flying Bats Football Club. And someone on our chat box on TNTradio.live, I think it was Mogden, said, yeah, didn't one girl get two broken legs playing against the team? I don't know whether it was two or one, but what happens in that scenario and what happens in the American scenario at a semi-elite level when, because of a very, very well-built biological man, transgender woman being overly aggressive, someone has a spinal injury and is in a wheelchair for the rest of their lives. Now, I don't want that to happen at all, but it's very likely it will happen, Sally.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, is that what it's going to take? And who's the woman, the girl or the woman that they're willing to sacrifice for that to happen? No, we want it to stop this before that happens because we know that that's where this is headed. Yeah. Gosh, has it already happened? There's so many things where it's swept under the rug, it's silenced, it's censored, that we know that there are more injuries out there that have not been reported on that through the back channels, we all know that they're happening. But if those women aren't willing to go public with it because they don't, you know, they don't want to go and turn their lives upside down like that. And they shouldn't have to. Someone who has been, you know, brutally injured by this shouldn't then have to go and beg for someone to care in the legal system or in politics. No, it should just already be done. They shouldn't be in this situation in the first place. It's like, so women like me who were in a position where we can talk about it. That's why we are, so that they don't have to go through any more of this just madness, this horribleness. It has to stop sooner rather than later.
Yeah. One last one before we let you go. We were discussing here what kind of politician wants to stand up for your argument in that court case, and of course none did. But a pledge by Western Australia's Liberal leader to ban the use of puberty blockers in children could be the start of a nationwide political battle on the issue, with party leaders in other states confirming they were scrutinising practices in the wake of that landmark United Kingdom review, which I've covered ad nauseum on this particular program. Oh, finally, someone on the other side of the country in WA recognising that we've got to follow the European example, we've got to follow the UK example, get with the times and realise there isn't enough data to support puberty blockers for people who have dysphoria.
Completely. I'm so happy and excited that Libby has done this, and hopefully she's going to inspire other politicians to speak up. Because honestly, how are any of them sleeping at night? Child abuse is happening right now. Why wouldn't you speak up? This is such a no-brainer. Just stop it immediately. Like, this should have been stopped yesterday. It should never have happened in the first place. Oh, are you scared of being called transphobic? You're scared of political pushback. You know who's scared? Detransitioners. Detransitioners who now have to go through the rest of their lives dealing with the health issues from the medical abuse they have received. They're scared. So if they can get up and speak up and get up every day and live their lives and try to recover from this, as a politician who is paid to represent all constituents, can get up and say, you know what? This isn't a great idea, medically abusing children for an experimental nonsense that should never have happened in the first place. It is literally the easiest political decision they'll ever make. Do it.
It is, and they need to do it. And I've been to the Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne many times. The level of expertise there is second to none. It's world class. But to think that they have a clinic dealing with 12-year-olds and there is an affirmation approach to what they do, and that they have said absolutely nothing officially on what has been reviewed and released in the United Kingdom is just, it's tantamount to not corruption, but it's tantamount to mismanagement and I think malpractice, given what they have in front of them, which is the lives of young children.
Oh, completely. If you have put a young child on puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones and then performed completely medically unnecessary surgeries on them, you belong in prison. You know better. The first thing as a doctor is do no harm, and all they're doing is harm.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I'll let you go. You've been very generous with your time on this Anzac Day. Thank you very much. We've got our fingers crossed for you. What's the date again of the decision that we can focus on?
Look, it's any time between the next 3 to 6 months. I expect like August, but I'm hoping maybe June, July would be really lovely, but we'll see. And then from that, it's 28 days to appeal to go to the High Court. And so, you know, I'm just ready for another year.
Exactly. Another year. So maybe the fat farm comes in 2026. Is that what you were trying to set up, a fat farm in 2026?
No, a female-only platform.
Platform, not a fat farm. I thought you were setting up a fat farm.
No, a female-only platform. That's all I want to do.
All right, okay. Sorry about that. I misinterpreted what you told me before, which is very ironic that I would say such a thing. Thank you so much for your time and all the very best. We'll catch up again.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Good on you, Sally Grover. What a mistake. Fancy construing what she wants to set up, which is basically a platform to a fat farm. Classic own goal. Let's take a break. I've got to get you some news. We'll do that. Coming up a stack more right here on TNT.
Now, big news, TNT Radio News.
Matt Boyland here with your TNT headlines. Tensions over Israel's war in Gaza have flared in America, with riot police clashing with students at colleges and universities across the country. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has responded to the uprising, demanding authorities do more to shut it down.
What's happening on America's college campuses is horrific.
And it's been revealed the US secretly shipped a batch of long-range missiles to Ukraine, which have been used to strike a Russian airfield.
We're the pinup boys and poster girls for free speech. We just don't look as impressive as Vladimir Putin shirtless on a horse. Yeah. 24/7, 365. We never stop sifting fact from fiction,
misinformation from the truth.
From government overreach to the latest on mandates, big tech censorship to propaganda gone mad. Listen to TNT Radio and get the news and views direct from our expert presenters and commentators anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
One of our viewers, Warwick from Foster on the New South Wales Mid-North Coast, has said, Chris, anyone who treasures freedom and free speech needs to see this excellent interview. It's Ralph Babbitt speaking with clarity, conviction and passion in exposing Albo's real secret agenda. The demented, ego-driven Lambie reveals what her agenda really is, and you can go and have a look at it. He's got a link here on this email, but look, you just have to look it up. You look up for Ralph Babbitt, Albo, and also Free Speech and Freedom, and I'm sure you'll be able to find it. Well, tens of thousands of people took to the streets in Argentina's capital, Buenos Aires, on Tuesday, as we discussed with John Ruddick. A mammoth number of protesters to demand increased funding for public universities. There's been much change in Argentina, as you know, since the election of President Javier Milei, and many around the world have followed the developments with interest, given the nation's history of political and economic upheaval. My next guest has only just been in Argentina a couple of weeks ago and will provide her insights from a libertarian perspective on what is happening. Dr. Melissa Albacete is an Argentinian libertarian activist who currently resides in Australia. She's been outspoken on the perils of socialism and big government. Melissa has a PhD in geography from the National University of the South in Argentina. She joins us live from Adelaide in South Australia. Melissa Albacete, welcome to TNT.
Hello, Chris. How are you? Thank you for having me on the show.
Fantastic to have you here. Firstly, as a libertarian, what are your thoughts on the attacks against Elon Musk by Prime Minister Anthony Albanese and essentially pushed by Australian mainstream media. You must have concerns about what this thin edge could lead to.
I'm truly concerned, to be honest, especially because I come now with Javier Milei. Hopefully we will have freedom. But I left Argentina because of a lack of freedom, basically. I've been targeted at university because I didn't have a voice and I couldn't basically talk about what I wanted to talk.
So you were going against the socialist wave, weren't you?
Yes, yes. And what it reminds me here, so what's going on with this misinformation and disinformation bill is what it's called the boiled frog syndrome. So I know you might hear about that, but it's when our living conditions deteriorate gradually, basically, and we adapt to these conditions instead of, you know, getting rid of them until you no longer, you know, are strong enough to escape. So the premise is that if you put, you know, a frog into a boiling water, then it will jump out. But if you just cook the frog slowly, it will die. And this is what is happening, what I can see is happening at the moment in Australia. And if we don't speak up against what is going on, we'll end up being like Argentina in the past or any other countries.
I actually think a lot of what the mainstream media is doing, that is supporting the government narrative on censorship, has got a lot to do with cancel culture. And I'll tell you why. Cancel culture has resulted in conservative voices mainly being cancelled because of complainants. So complainants have come on and got stuck into media organisations over the last 8 to 10 years in Australia because of what has been said. And Alan Jones was a classic example of that, to the stage where they would go on a campaign to ensure that no advertiser advertised on the programs of those conservative commentators. And so all of a sudden, the content being broadcast either on television or radio made a difference to the owners of these corporations, because all of a sudden they didn't have a model that they could sell advertising on. And many of these hosts, including Alan Jones, have been kicked off. And so I think that there's been directives, and I don't know specifically, but I know how they work because I've worked there, but there have been directives from various newsroom chiefs about what side of this censorship debate they should follow, because they don't want to be the subject of major complaints and be cancelled.
That is correct. And that happened in Argentina before Javier Milei arrives in power.
Right.
But the previous government did exactly the same, Chris, exactly the same. They provided money to the mainstream companies, so they have the money to say whatever they want. And of course they were buying, you know, journalists at that time. They were buying their voices. So these journalists, they don't have their own voice, but they get, you know, they check from the government. So why is so important that Elon Musk is basically providing us with a platform with everyone have a say? Yeah. Is extremely, extremely important. And you know, he's spending his own money. Like, I think it's around 40 billion of his own money to give all the people a voice, while unfortunately the Australian government has been, you know, wasting, I think it's around 450 million of other people's money on a failed referendum to create a voice for a chosen few.
True. They are the correct amounts too, by the way. They are the correct amounts. Well said. But you're right. So they spend that amount of money when they could have spent it far better in many other areas. And then we've got a situation now where they want to cancel not only what's on and being shown on the internet in Australia, they want to have jurisdiction with the rest of the world, Melissa.
It is insane. It looks like China. So if as Elon Musk said, so what happens if one country is allowed, you know, to censor content for all countries, which is, as you said, what is the Australian eSafety Commissioner is demanding. You know what? I'm very capable of reading, looking, any material, and deciding what is good for me and on for my life. But the fact that the eSafety Commissioner has, you know, has to control the access of information. So what are the unintended or intended consequences of an elected, government bureaucrat empowered to shut down anything they don't like, because this is what they are going for, and yeah. shut down worldwide. What are the, unintended consequences of that? Just imagine if you, if we get the Chinese law applied into Australia, for example, what are the consequences of that? Yeah. So what Australia needs to understand that, of course, Australia law does not extend to having the ability to take down content globally, okay? And governments have no rights, just powers delegated to them by the people, and only people have rights.
You make a very, very good point. Let's push that aside for 1 second. Given the protest in Argentina, such as the current one over funding for public universities, is there much division in the population with support for the protesters versus support for the government? Because they're going through a major change, right?
Look, I think Javier Milei will keep the same percentage of people who is willing to support him. The problem with public education in Argentina is Milei has touched one of the most important roots, especially in middle class. Mm-hmm. Argentina, I think, is the only country in Latin America which has public education, so it's free education, free access to education at all. So, Chris, mm-hmm. if you want to go and study an undergraduate or a bachelor's there, you are very welcome to go and study for free without contributing any penny to the Argentinian taxpayers. So what Javier Milei did was basically the wage bill allocated to public universities has decreased, yes, by around, I think it's 30%. Mm-hmm. So what Javier Milei wants to do is to preserve the budget surplus as a prior step to stabilizing the economy.
That'd be a good change.
Yes, indeed. And what is happening is that the state university sector does not want to bear the necessary cost of the adjustment, and they want the adjustment to be borne by others.
Yeah.
And what Javier Milei is basically saying, I'm not privatizing university, I'm not shutting down universities, I just want to audit university funds to ensure that the money is being used appropriately. Now, unfortunately, universities in Argentina can manage their own budget in a very discretionary way without explanations to the Argentinian people. So they want to continue using the money for their
political. But it's not their money, it's taxpayers' money.
Well, that's what they think. They think is their money, and everyone should fund the university. And unfortunately, well, we can go and check data. And this is something, and it's a very sensitive issue for Argentinians, but we need to talk about foreign students going to Argentina and they study for free. And when they finish their studies, they go back to their countries without paying any penny.
Right. And
this is a discussion we have to give. We have around 2.7 million of students in Argentina, and around 122,000 are foreign students who are not paying for the services. And what Javier Milei is saying, okay, everyone is trying to overcome an economic crisis at the moment. Everyone is making an effort. So why it's wrong to charge foreign students with a fee so the money can be invested properly, university infrastructure, salary, anything else?
It's very much common sense, and I hope he gets it all through and hope he can make it happen. One final thing. What other aspects of Argentina did you notice have changed dramatically under him during your trip?
I think people have more hope.
Right.
Last time I went to Argentina was in 2022, and people were completely devastated. However, today what I could feel is the fact that I can see hope in their eyes. And they are willing to go to this adjustment. So that we need to fix the fiscal deficit, and Milei is doing really well. So inflation is decreasing, but it's going to cost a lot to Argentinians. But I think we're heading to the right pathway. hopefully we will see freedom at the end of
the day. There's got to be sacrifice for freedom, and that's exactly the path that he's setting the Argentinian country on. I've run out of time, but thank you so much for yours on this Anzac Day and appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
No problem. That's Melissa Albacete, Dr. Melissa Albacete, Argentinian libertarian activist who can speak on so many issues, and we'll get her back on the program in the not-too-distant future because she has a really good mindset as to what's happening with big government around the world and the impact that will have on our freedom as well. Let's take a break. Let's dedicate the next 15 minutes to Anzac Day and an amazing story from an amazing part of the world, which occurred on this day way, way back, more than a century ago. This is Chris Smith on TNT.
Here's a bushfire fact. Bushfires can occur without warning. So if you're travelling during bushfire season, here are three simple steps to remember. One, check the fire danger rating before you go. The higher the fire danger rating, the more dangerous the conditions. It may be safer to replan your trip. Two, think about the area you're going to and what you would do if a fire started. How would you escape the area if you needed to? And where would you go? Check if there's a neighbourhood safer place. Three, it's dangerous to drive through smoke or fire. If you can't find a way to avoid the fire, park in a cleared area, face the car towards the fire, and turn the engine off. Then lie on the floor and cover yourself to protect yourself from radiant heat. Live bushfire ready. For more helpful tips, visit myfireplan.com.au today.
Asthma is a growing problem, especially among children. Asthma affects the quality of life for millions like me every single day. My name is Chris Draft, and I have asthma. And I've spent more than a decade in the NFL tackling asthma on and off the field. Join me and the EPA in helping people control their asthma. Asthma is a lung condition that can be controlled through medication and by avoiding things that can make it worse. Three steps are the solution to controlling asthma. Step one, talk to a doctor. Step two, make a plan. And step three, get rid of things that can make it worse. Asthma can be tackled. For more information on asthma, log on to epa.gov/asthma.
This is the Chris Smith Show on today's News Talk.
TNT Radio.
As I said at the start of the program, April 25, Anzac Day, an important day for Australians and in other countries that, of course, participated in the Gallipoli campaign. For our international viewers, Anzac Day is a national day of remembrance in Australia and New Zealand that commemorates Australians and New Zealanders who served and died in all wars, as a matter of fact, all conflicts. My next guest will discuss some of this with historical context. Dr. Will Davies is a war historian, battlefield guide, and the author of 10 books. He has 37 years of experience in the Australian film and television industry. He's a documentary maker. He joins me live from Sydney. Will Davies, welcome to TNT.
Thanks, Chris, very much.
Now, we're going to talk about Villers Bretonneux, a place that you've been many times, a place that I've been on two occasions on this day, on Anzac Day.
And we work together.
You've been very much part of those broadcasts. And I, since we have been there together, do you know that I learnt after that period, and I haven't told you this, that my great-great-uncle, Bernard Austin Musto, fought in the Second Battle of Villers Bretonneux?
Wow. How good's that?
Yeah, which is quite amazing. Give us the background of that battle, if you can.
Okay. So what we're talking about is a battle that happened 106 years ago today. Anzac Day, it started on the night of the 24th, went through to the 25th. Now, I should go back a bit because this is needs a bit of context and a bit of background. We're talking about 1918, the last year of the war. In March 1918, the Germans were at a point where they had 60 divisions from the Eastern Front. Now, 60 divisions is a division is about 10,000 to 15,000 men plus guns and all the other necessities. It's a lot of men by 60, right?
Wow.
Now, on the other hand, that's 600,000 plus troops suddenly available to them with the fall of the Eastern Front. The Americans, on the other hand, are lining up a million men to bring to Europe. So the Germans need to have a final big push before the Americans arrive in force and take Paris and win the war. So on the 21st of March 1918, they launch Operation Michael. They drive the British back. The British are pushed back 60 kilometres within about a week and a half. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's unheard of in the First World War. It's a rout. As Haig said, General Haig said, this is, we've got our backs to the wall. I mean, we're really going to lose this war. Now, the Australians at the time were in rest. They'd been training. They were very fresh soldiers. But they're up in Belgium around Messines. They were rushed to the Somme. And the idea was that they would form a defensive line across the line of the Somme River, north-south, and protect the big city of Amiens. Now, Amiens was the supply point of the Allies. That's the supplies railway station, railhead for the Somme.
But having said that, you've got Germans with tanks this time around, right?
Not yet, right? Tanks. The Germans only built 20 tanks. They were monsters. They had 17 to 25 men in them. They were, you know, huge lumbering monsters that did sort of 15 k's an hour. So they're right. Very, very slow. They hadn't come on the scene at this point, although they had been used at various points in one-day campaigns to the north. But
right.
But we'll get to that. So the Australians are pulled down. They form this long defensive line, probably 20 k's long, very thinly manning the line. Meanwhile, the British are fleeing. I mean, they're just saying, what the hell are you guys doing? The Germans are coming. Let's go. The Australians said no. In fact, villagers were loading stuff onto wagons. When they saw the Australians, they said, no need to load the wagons. And the Australians actually helped them take the furniture off and put it back in their houses. So the Australians are very confident. They, as I said, we had five divisions. So we're talking about 10,000 divisions. We've got 50,000 men available to form that barrier. But the Germans have got 600,000 men. Now, so the first battle of Villebretonneau started about I think it ended on the 5th of April. So that was the first time that the Germans had Germans had driven along the line, the east-west line, through the village of Villebretonneau, because on the south of the line was held by the French army. To the north of the line was held by the British army. Now, they didn't speak to each other. They had no common language. They had no common weapons, calibers, food, anything. So the Germans knew this, and it was a very weak point in the Allied front. So they drove along the line. They got to Villebretonneau. In the first battle of Villebretonneau, they pretty much pushed the Allies back to the outer side. The British counterattacked. And then there was a bit of a lull while they all settled down. And then the second battle of Villebretonneau started about the 23rd of April. And the Germans again, and this is when the tanks came in on the 24th, the Germans only ever built 20 tanks, and 13 were committed to this attack on Villebretonneau, because over on the horizon is the major city of Amiens, and they can see it.
Yeah,
that's the prize.
Yeah, you can see it. We've seen it from the hill at Villebretonneau.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. You can almost touch it.
That's right, and there they can see the prize. So they push the British through on the 24th. On the night of the 23rd, 24th, they push the British to the wrong end of Villebretonneau village. They call in the Australians and they say, we want you to attack at 9 a.m. The Australians say, no way. It's daytime. We're not organised. We'll do it tonight. So it was a pretty blunt response to Rawlinson saying, no, we're not going to listen to you and we'll attack on our terms. So the Australians attacked in two formations. They went around the village of Villebretonneau, New South Wales, mainly New South Wales 13th Brigade under Glasgow.
William Glasgow.
That's right, Sir William Glasgow. And you might remember his family were at the service that day.
At the centenary.
Yeah, and then the Victorian 15th attacked, that's Pompey Elliot, around to the north of the village. And the idea was they'd come together and they'd block the Germans into Villa Bretna and they'd capture a whole mob of them. As it happened, they didn't. They didn't close the gap. Some Germans got through on the railway, along the railway line, but there was mass slaughter. And when you read Bean about the Victorians attacking Villa Bretonneau, they could see the Germans in the light of the burning village, and they just attacked with the bayonet. It was a night of, as Bean says, when every bayonet instructor would be very proud.
So the Victorians were the ones who came over the rise and helped the New South Welshmen?
No, they came over the rise through where the Australian National Memorial is today. The New South Wales 13th were around on the southern side,
right,
well out of sight of them, and they're attacking to enclose and encircle the village.
Right. And so after that assault, what was the outcome?
Well, basically, as I said, they didn't quite link up. Germans escaped, but it returned the front line to the western side, to the eastern side of Villa Bretonneur. And in the weeks after that, probably a month after that, there was a bit of to and froing, a lot of what the Australians termed peaceful penetration, which was night raiding. They loved night raiding. And they, you know, when they call for volunteers, every hand went up because this was sort of fun to them. The other thing they did is something called nibbling, where in the night they'd push out 20 metres and dig some more little one-man, two-man holes, and then the next night they'd join the holes up. So they'd just advance their line 20 metres towards the Germans, and then they'd nibble again. So this nibbling and this trench raiding went on. The Germans were they were scared. Yeah, it was not the place to be in that front, in that section of the front for the Germans. They just
and to this very day, you go back to Villa Bretonneur, and I think a lot of people who haven't been there should understand that the Australians are not forgotten, are they, Will?
Not forgotten. As we know, mate, you would have gone to the Victoria School, and there's that big sign that just says, "Never forget Australia." And, of course, you see the little plaques all over the area. But one interesting incident that I came across was I take gum leaves and I burn them in the trenches, because the men used to get a couple of gum leaves, and you can imagine them huddled in the bottom of a trench smelling the eucalyptus, the gum trees. So we burn the leaves and let the smoke blow over the graves. But I went into our Army Inn to get some matches. And as the guy's handing me the matches, he says, "Where are you from?" And I said, "Australia." He said, "You have the matches, because if it wasn't for you guys, we'd be speaking German today." This is 100 years later, you know? Yeah. I mean, I just shake my head and go, how good's that?
It's just passed on from generation to generation about what occurred.
It has. And this sort of quiet reverence and this quiet respect.
And I know a lot of people talk about at one stage in your life as part of your, ticking off what you've got to do in life.
Your bucket list.
I was just about to say, people talk about going to Gallipoli, but having not been to Gallipoli, I can't make a comparison with Villa Bretonneur, but I can tell you right now that you would do yourself an enormous favour by, one, going to Villa Bretonneur for a dawn service on Anzac Day, as many Australians would do today, but also going to see that incredible underground war museum that has been built there too.
Like there's so much to see there, and people say to me, well, it's 100 years ago. What's left to see? Well, you know, to be honest, there's not a lot, but I take tours, as you know, and the one thing I'm confronted with is trying to explain to people, because they've got images of the First World War. They're black and white. They're of upturned wagons, dead horses, churned up ground, and, you know, there's a great disconnect between what they're seeing now and these sort of laser-planed, verdant fields of wheat. No sign of dead horses and upturned wagons. And making that shift in their mind is quite hard. You go to a cemetery and you go, oh, hello, you know, there's 1,000 Australians lying here, four boys of 18 and plus, you know.
Yeah. You start to see the headstones that say, you know, 18, 19, et cetera. It's just quite amazing. I've run out of time. I've got to leave you there, Will. I'm sure you've had an active Anzac Day. Thank you for all you've done to remember those who sacrificed their lives in war, mate. You're a soldier and a half. Thank you so much.
A quick one, mate. I've got a new granddaughter today. Announcing it first time to the world.
Fabulous. Well done. Congratulations. A perfect synchronicity. Thank you so much, Will. Dr. Will Davies, historian, battlefield guide, and also another grandfather. He's a grandfather for, I think, the third time, which is fantastic. Oh, is that right? Thank you, mate. I've got to go. I'll leave you in the safe hands of Sonia Poulton, who's coming to you from the UK. We'll come back and do it again tomorrow at the same time. Thank you so much for listening in or watching. This is Chris Smith on TNT.